From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2016 when Rochester police were searching for a vehicle and they stopped the wrong car. Then a police officer for the RPD shot the passenger in that car in the back three times. The passenger's name was Sylvan Simmons. Officer said that Simmons fired first at the police and Simmons was charged with the crime. Well, what was their evidence? The story was recently told by Todd Feathers, a freelance journalist who focuses on technology for Vice's Motherboard. I'm going to quote Feathers at length here. Quote, the only evidence against Simmons came from ShotSpotter. Initially, the company's sensors did not detect any gunshots, and the algorithms ruled that the sounds came from helicopter rotors. After Rochester police contacted ShotSpotter, an analyst then ruled that there had been four gunshots, the number of times police officers fired at Simmons missing once. Paul Green, ShotSpotter's expert witness and an employee of the company, testified at Simmons' trial that subsequently he was asked by the Rochester Police Department to essentially search and see if there were more shots fired than ShotSpotter initially picked up, according to a civil lawsuit Simmons has filed against the city and the company. Green then found, yes, a fifth shot, despite there being no physical evidence at the scene that Simmons had fired. Rochester police had also refused Simmons multiple requests for them to test his hands and clothing for gunshot residue. Curiously, the ShotSpotter audio files that were the only evidence of the phantom fifth shot have now disappeared. Both the company and the Rochester Police Department lost, deleted, and/or destroyed the spool and/or other information containing sounds pertaining to the officer-involved shooting, according to Simmons' civil suit. Green acknowledged at a plaintiff's criminal trial that employees of ShotSpotter and law enforcement customers with an audio editor can alter any audio file that's not been locked or encrypted. A jury ultimately acquitted Simmons of attempted murder, and a judge overturned his conviction for possession of a gun, citing ShotSpotter's unreliability, end quote. And I want to just put a fine point on some of what the reporting said there, because if you're not familiar with this case, it is difficult to fully process what happened. They were looking for a car. They stopped the wrong car, and a rather large and aggressive Rochester police officer then chased Simmons, who was scared for his life, and shot him three times. The shots hit him in the back, the buttocks, and the thigh, and they said that he had a gun. He says he doesn't even own a gun, and he begged them to test for evidence. Anyway, as Feathers describes in his piece, the Rochester case is just one of multiple instances in which police have received analysis from ShotSpotter and then asked the company to go back in and see if they could dig up other evidence, and then the company, who they're paying, has obliged. On top of that, the company's claims about the accuracy of ShotSpotter are based on their own internal analysis, not verification from outside sources. So we reached out to a wide range of people to join us on this, and let me welcome our guests who are with us now. The freelance reporter writing about tech for Vice and Motherboard is Todd Feathers. He's on the line with us. Todd, thanks for making time for the program.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Let me welcome in studio, Katie Higgins is a senior assistant public defender from Monroe County. Katie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Elizabeth Riley, Liz is a special assistant public defender. Liz, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Iman Abed Thompson is director of the Genesee Valley chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Iman, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
No response from the Rochester Police Department. We reached out to them. And let me go ahead and read a statement because we asked the district attorney to come on and talk about this. The district attorney was not available, but the office of Sandra Dorley sent us this statement. Quote, ShotSpotter is an investigative tool that can be useful for law enforcement to respond to deadly situations. While this technology may be an important resource for law enforcement, the Monroe County District Attorney Office has not actively used ShotSpotter as evidence in trials over the past 2 years. Currently, we heavily scrutinize all ShotSpotter evidence that comes into our office relating to a case, end quote. So the DA's office saying, can help police, but we're not using it as evidence, and we haven't for 2 years. We'll talk about that coming up. I've also reached out to members of Rochester City Council who are, I'm still waiting to get a final number on the contract. Do we know, by the way, Liz, do we know exactly how much Rochester is paying ShotSpotter?
I don't know that
information. Okay, yeah, okay. So, I mean, we'll have to find out. In some cities, it's millions of dollars. It's a lot of money. And Rochester's paying for this, even though the DA's office says we're not going to use it as evidence, and you've got cases like the Simmons case. So I asked city council, are you going to keep doing this? And multiple members of council tell me there's a lot of inertia. It's hard to change status quo, but this will be under review soon, especially with Rochester having a new mayor likely and a new police chief likely. So there's a lot to for them to review there. Todd Feathers, how did this get on your radar in the first place?
Yeah, so initially we had published an article about a week before this one looking at several cities that have installed ShotSpotter and using data based on the locations of ShotSpotter alerts over a period of years to kind of, as a proxy, to map out where the ShotSpotter sensors are located in the city. And we found, which was unsurprising to a lot of the folks who have been pushing back against this technology in their cities, that the sensors are almost exclusively located in communities and neighborhoods that are majority Black and Brown. And you know, the white enclaves of the various cities have no sensors whatsoever. And as part of that, one of the kind of key cases or cities that we were looking at was Chicago. And the piece mentions two cases in Chicago where ShotSpotter analysts altered, changed, adjusted, whatever phrase you want to use, reports in murder trials after being asked to essentially look for more evidence by police.
Can you describe briefly, if you don't mind, Todd, you know, we talked a little bit about the Rochester case. We're going to talk about that in a moment with the attorneys who are with us and with Imani Abid Thompson from NYCLU. But can you tell us a little bit about, for example, the Chicago case that you're talking about?
Yeah, so all three of the cases we looked at, ShotSpotter was, you know, among the most important evidence brought against the defendants. The first case in Chicago is a murder case against a man named Michael Williams, and he was charged with shooting a 25-year-old man in his car and later dropping him off at the hospital. In that case, the kind of key evidence that tied Williams to the shooting was a ShotSpotter alert that placed the shot at a location at a time where security camera had Williams' car stopped. And Williams had told police that the passenger in his car, who was the victim, was hit and killed by a drive-by shooter. The ShotSpotter alert initially, according to court records, actually classified the sound at that location as a firecracker, and it wasn't actually at that location. It was a location about a mile away. Mm-hmm. Over a period of months, ShotSpotter analysts at the request of police went back and looked at it and changed the classification to a gunshot and changed the location to one that matched where Williams' car was seen on security cameras. And that was the key piece of evidence to place him there at the time of the shooting.
Todd,
in case,
can I interrupt for a second? So when you're talking about a case in which the initial technological analysis from ShotSpotter says it was a firecracker and it was a mile away, and their client, who is a city or a police department who are paying them a lot of money, says go back and look again, and they come back and say, oh no, you know, we're going to go ahead and amend that. That raises instant alarm bells for me, and I know your reporting is meant just to allow people to draw their own conclusions here, but is there reason to be concerned that ShotSpotter is essentially just serving a client who's asking for specific, sort of a menu of specific things, as opposed to just, hey, tell us what you found and we'll deal with it?
I think we should always keep in mind, you know, who's paying the bill for police technology or for technology like this. You know, when courts and some of the attorneys on here, I'm sure, can speak to this much better than I do, but when courts consider the qualifications of expert witnesses, they take into account, you know, the biases and the compensation that they may be receiving. The same should be true for forensic techniques, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. All right, so can you briefly describe one other case? You were going to do that. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Sure. So the second case involves a man named Ernesto Godinez, who was charged with shooting a federal agent in Chicago. And ShotSpotter in that case had initially picked up two gunshots in the area where the shooting occurred. And there was surveillance footage showing a doorway in which Godinez is seen going into the doorway. There are no muzzle flashes that appear. Godinez is seen a short time after the shooting leaving the doorway. Police found five shell casings in the vicinity of that doorway, but those shell casings couldn't be matched to the bullets that hit the federal agent. This is where ShotSpotter came in. The company was asked to relook at their alerts for that time, and they, after being asked by federal investigators and Chicago police, discovered five more gunshots that they had not previously, perfectly matching the number of shell casings in the area. Godinez was convicted in a federal court on that charge, but he is currently appealing it in large part because he was not allowed to challenge the validity of the ShotSpotter evidence or the qualifications of the expert witness, who is a ShotSpotter employee who testified.
Iman Abid Thompson, who is director of the Genesee Valley chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union, can you just give me some sort of the broad outline of your thoughts on ShotSpotter and how it's used?
I mean, just looking at it and from what we know about it here in Rochester, it's an incredibly invasive tool that can be tampered with. Information can be deleted. And as we can clearly see in these case studies, including Sylvan Simmons' case, which we're going to hear a little bit more about later, these sorts of devices themselves, which are man-made, created with algorithms that can be incredibly biased as well, are often found, you know, we find ourselves often using them and relying on them and having police officers consistently depend on these sorts of devices that have been deeply flawed from the beginning. So I think these are devices and technology, and ShotSpotter is not the only invasive surveillance tool that we use, right? There are many other ones, which we hope to talk about a little bit later. But in regards to ShotSpotter, I think it's shown time and time again that it's not working, and that it's something that if police officers can tamper with, it should be completely done away with. It immediately gives disregard to the individual who's caught up in an incident, and an incident, an individual who has no access to the device itself, as an officer does. So I think it's something that people should be aware of. It's present here in Rochester. It's still being used. It hasn't been used properly, and it's actually shown incorrect, you know, results from like the false positive rates of identifying fireworks as gunshots in many cases as well, and vice versa. I think these are things that we definitely need to consider. I think at the end of the day too, we need to remind ourselves that City of Rochester taxpayers are paying for this. And it's really important to recognize that it's a device that again is deeply flawed and should be done away with.
We're going to come back to how ShotSpotter defends it, because I think in Todd Feather's piece, he at least gives you a window into how the company describes what they're doing or how accurate it is. But before we get there, let me ask Liz Riley and Katie Higgins about the Simmons case. So the case comes to you. My understanding of the case, please let me kind of give another overview and please correct where any of this is wrong. So you have Rochester police in 2016 searching for a car. And what they see, I guess, the same model. They think that they may be seeing the car that they're looking for. And an officer who had a number of complaints already filed against him, pretty big guy, follows the car and then gets out and approaches it. It turns out it was the wrong car. It was Sylvan Simmons in the passenger seat. He's with his next door neighbor. They said they had gone to the store. They're just coming back from the store. And they're in Sylvan Simmons' driveway where he lives with his girlfriend in Rochester. And the police officer is aggressively, instantly, I guess, shouting at Simmons and the driver. There's understandably, I mean, it's night, it's dark, there's fear, and Simmons takes off, I guess, to the side of the house, where the officer shoots him three times, once in the back, once in the buttocks, once in the thigh. So the shots didn't hit him in the chest, and I mean, he was turned around, but the claim from the officer was that Simmons pulled a gun and fired it, and the officer was scared for his life and fired four shots, apparently hit him three times. Apparently no gun found at the scene. Simmons is saying, I don't own a gun. I don't have a gun. I didn't shoot a gun. And so he's in the hospital. He survives it, but he's on a ventilator. He wakes up to find out that he is being viewed as the perpetrator and the police officer is the victim. The police officer was not hurt. And Simmons is, who cannot talk, he's on a ventilator, is writing written requests saying, please check my clothes, check me for gunshot residue, check anything, please do it. You're not going to find anything. I don't have a gun. Even before he had an attorney, he's doing all of this. So all of this stuff stacks up to me. I don't know. I mean, Liz, Katie, I'm sure you're great attorneys, but this doesn't look like that hard of a case for you. I don't mean to be flippant.
Sure. Yeah, I mean,
it's remarkable.
It certainly did not seem like it should have been that hard of a case. And we were mindful that ShotSpotter technology was in the community, and be it good or bad, once we were involved We actively pursued as much evidence that we could get, including the ShotSpotter audio, and we sent letters to Preserve to both the police department and to the ShotSpotter Corporation back on April 13th, 2016, where we asked that both the Rochester Police Department take steps and that the corporation take steps to preserve any technology. I'm quoting from the letter here, not limited to reports regarding time, location, triangulation, diagrams, aerial maps, and audio data with regard to the time frame in which Sylvan was shot, because it at that very beginning of the case, even before we had any evidence, the discovery laws were at the time such that we didn't have a lot of information that we would now get this close into the case, hopefully. But even at that point, shooting in the dark, we knew that we wanted to preserve any audio that there was for our own purposes. And that sort of flies in the face of our conversation here, but it's relevant because we asked them to preserve it. They didn't preserve it. And as it turns out, it's not that reliable anyway, but that was a step that we took in this case.
You want to add to that, Katie? And grab that microphone, get real, yeah.
I would add that when the reporter with the Vice article mentions that the audio had been destroyed or that it was no longer found, what happened was there was audio that basically gets clipped out of, there are individual sensors in the city, and each one basically is a microphone, and that is recording all raw audio. If something is detected in the system automatically, or if a ShotSpotter employee goes in and manually asks to save that, it gets a part of that gets clipped out. And that was explained away by ShotSpotter as actually in response to concerns by the ACLU that this is potentially invading citizens' privacy, picking up conversations of people in their yards or walking in the street and all of that, so that they clip out the audio of what they refer to as an acoustical impulse, and then that gets sent to a server in the cloud. The spools, the raw audio microphones, get rewritten over every 72 hours. And so there was an audio clipping of multiple shots that was provided by ShotSpotter to the Rochester Police and the prosecution in Sylvan's case. However, the raw audio of exactly what was picked up by any microphone was deleted after the 72-hour period. The Rochester Police had actually reached out to ShotSpotter within the hour after Officer Ferrigno had shot Sylvan, asking them to check the sensors for any audio and preserve that. They never asked them to preserve the raw audio data, and so there's a lot of problems with how what was chosen to be clipped out. At first, only three impulses were found by the system, then four, and then after RPD asked them to search for additional shots that may have been fired by the suspect, as they put it, they found what they are referring to as a fifth shot that was on a separate audio spool. And so there was audio that was provided and was played for the jury over and over in Sylvan's case. However, that was not the original raw audio data. It had been clipped and edited.
Okay. There's a lot here. First of all, what gun are they claiming Sylvan used? Was there a gun produced?
There was a gun that was located somewhere between 10 to 20 feet away from where Sylvan was laying face down in his own backyard with gunshots in his back. Officer Ferrigno was the one who allegedly found the firearm within maybe 3 or 4 minutes after he shot Sylvan. The gun was not loaded. It was in a strange position where it didn't eject the casing as it should have. So there's a casing loaded, there was a casing stuck in the chamber, no further bullets. And when it came back from the lab where it had been tested for DNA, there was DNA located on the gun. It did not match Sylvan.
So whose gun was that?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Okay. They're saying, RPD said it was Sylvan's.
Mm-hmm. That was certainly their claim.
That was their claim. Okay. Is it plausible that police claim, hey, this guy shot at us, And Sylvain says, absolutely not. I'm running. I'm scared for my life. You got the wrong guy and you shoot me. And you say, well, fine, let's ask ShotSpotter. And ShotSpotter comes back and says, no, we've got the four shots that the officer fired, and that's all we got. And police say, no, go back again, ShotSpotter. See what you find a second time. And then ShotSpotter comes back and says, no, we got a fifth one now. Here it is. Is it plausible that the initial run, whatever that spool was, wouldn't have caught that one?
We don't know a lot about the technology because ShotSpotter is so private as to how this works and how
but
this
how
is
do you
captured.
Miss? I mean, like, if it's all happening right here in the same space, gunshots are not quiet. Why is one spool only getting one and one spool? What is happening that we missed it?
Well, one of the issues was that the when we were told that the ShotSpotter system was in squelch mode was how ShotSpotter referred to it. We didn't know what that was until we were at trial because we weren't given the opportunity to get any information from ShotSpotter prior to trial. But at trial, Paul Green, the employee from ShotSpotter, explained that essentially that meant that one acoustical impulse was so far removed geographically from the others that the system was not able to triangulate it to the proper location. And so it mutes the system more or less and does not alert Rochester police. So Rochester police never were alerted to these gunshots that obviously Officer Frigno certainly fired because the system had put itself into squelch mode because it was not able to geographically locate one of those shots who was so far outside of the range.
Okay. And by the way, if you're curious, listeners, what was Sylvain Simmons charged with? What was he charged with?
He was charged with attempted aggravated murder of a police officer, attempted aggravated assault on a police officer, and two counts of criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree. The jury acquitted him of the first count that required that they believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed a loaded firearm, an operable loaded firearm, and that he did so with the intent to use it unlawfully against another, in this case, Officer Frigno. The jury convicted him of the fourth count, which was criminal possession of a weapon outside his home or place of business, clearly because of the ShotSpotter evidence. They had the audio that they listened to over and over and over again over days, and they could hear that there were these sounds, these acoustical impulses, and they had to come from somewhere, and there was that fifth tone. The problem is, and what's really important to highlight here, is that the only audio that was preserved was 8 seconds. And within those 8 seconds, there are four very, very clear shots that we know came from Officer Ferrigno's firearm. And then there is, prior to that, a much fainter acoustical impulse. And it could be absolutely anything. So because we didn't have the ability to analyze or challenge whether or not that was a, you know, jackhammer or it was
a firecracker,
any number of things going on that night. If it was a consistent impulse, it just sounds like a ting. It was much lighter than the four shots because we couldn't analyze it, because we couldn't make arguments to the jury that this fifth impulse was not convincing as being a shot. We lost that ability, and that's what Judge Chacho based his decision in part to throw out that conviction on the what I consider to be the most minor charge.
Yeah, and police have never disputed the fact that Simmons was not the guy they were looking for, right? I mean, they've acknowledged that. They had the wrong guy.
Correct.
And they end up shooting the wrong guy. And if that makes you scratch your head, think about this. Anybody listening right now, if an officer thinks that they need you for something, and they got the wrong person, and all of a sudden they see you and you're walking down the street and they start running at you. If you turn and run, and the officer trips and breaks their ankle, what happens?
You get charged with a violent felony, assault second against a police officer.
Okay. All right. So that's the story of Sylvain Simmons, you know, and I don't know if I can even sort of ask that. I'm just curious. I mean, the piece, Reuters did a deep dive, and Reuters' story is worth reading. But how is Sylvain Simmons doing?
He's doing okay. He's back at work. He had the same job consistently since he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. The company stood behind him. They were They could not have been more supportive. The owners of the company came to court appearances, and he's working there now. He's not able to do the same job that he did before, which required heavy lifting, and so he's not able to work as he did before, but he is certainly back at work with the same company, and they've taken care of him. But he lost at least 18 months of his life, and I say that because that was the amount of time he was in custody awaiting trial. And, you know, he's losing normal enjoyment of every day as we speak just because of what he was put through.
Have police ever said, look, to Sylvan, you dispute what happened here, but we know that you weren't the guy we were looking for and we're sorry? I mean, like, have police ever walked back in any way, in any sense? The police union, Mike Mazzeo, was out of the scene that night, as I understand it. Has he ever walked it back and said, we got to make sure we're not shooting the wrong people?
The only thing that we're aware of that the police ever said to Sylvan was after Judge Chacho reversed the sole conviction, which resulted in all of the charges therefore being dismissed, where multiple police officers, including Ferrigno and some of Ferrigno's family members, threatened Sylvan and said that we should have taken care of you while you were on the ground.
Where are we hearing this from? What's the source?
This was in the courtroom.
This was in the courtroom?
This was in the courtroom, and the news was actually present in the courtroom while this was said.
What was Ferrigno's record before this all happened with Sylvan Simmons?
He had multiple civilian complaints filed against him. At trial, he agreed with me that it was more than 24. I don't know what the actual count is, but it's at least 24. When folks knew that there was a civilian who was shot by a police officer and it was named that this was the police officer, there wasn't a lot of surprise. This wasn't exactly the gentle officer friendly that you see on the corner that folks would say there must have been a reason. The general sentiment in the community was, well, that was bound to happen. So it's unfortunate. And I will say, just to add to what Katie said, we were present for those statements. We're in very close contact with Sylvan now. So if anybody had reached out to him, certainly we would be aware of that.
Where is Officer Ferrigno now?
He is still employed by Rochester Police Department. Our understanding is that he has been essentially off the street on some sort of medical leave since this incident. So he's still being paid. He still has his salary and his pension, but as far as we know, he's not been back on the street.
But he could. Conceivably, he could. He could go back out and work on the street. There's no reason in his files that he can't?
Oh, he wasn't disciplined whatsoever for this incident.
Right. Okay.
In fact, he was given accommodation afterwards.
Okay. Again, I want to stress what we invited the Rochester Police Department to join us. No response from them. The district attorney's office provided a statement saying that ShotSpotter can be I'll go ahead and read this again. ShotSpotter, this is the statement from Sandra Dorley, this district attorney's office. Quote, ShotSpotter is an investigative tool that can be useful for law enforcement to respond to deadly situations. While this technology may be an important resource for law enforcement, the Monroe County District Attorney's Office has not actively used ShotSpotter as evidence in trials over the past 2 years. Currently, we heavily scrutinize all ShotSpotter evidence that comes into our office relating to a case. End quote. Iman Abid Thompson from the Genesee Valley chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union here. As we sort of review not only this case, but understand discipline or, you know, sort of what the bounds of what police can do, we're talking about armed members of the state. Mm-hmm. What are the lessons as you see them from this case?
Well, I mean, in this case specifically, we're talking about an infamously known officer, Officer Ferrigno, mixed with an incredibly faulty device, trying to make a case against a black man. And like, this is a case that very often throughout Rochester, we consistently refer to as exactly why policing has been such a failure and why we need to start defunding and disciplining these sorts of officers. Officer Ferrigno should have been off the force a long time ago. And as it was mentioned, we don't even know actually if he's been disciplined at all with the number of complaints used against him. And not just with Sylvan Simmons. I mean, this man has been using excessive force over and over again against Black and brown people in the city of Rochester. And even then, stories that have been shared with us, you know, as activists throughout the city of Rochester, as myself in the NYCLU, these are stories that we take very seriously, but it doesn't seem that the RPD has taken as seriously. And it's extremely concerning. I think there was an article that was released a couple of months ago, maybe last year at some point, specifically on Officer Ferrigno's record and just how problematic he is. And I believe he makes over $100,000. And I take it back to the fact that the city of Rochester residents, the same ones who are facing the negative and disparate impact of these systems, are the ones paying for these systems. We're paying for Officer Ferrigno to stay on the force. We're paying for ShotSpotter. And I think, Katie, you brought this point up too. We don't even know how these sorts of devices are actually being used. Information out there, I mean, the open data portal that Rochester Police Department has nothing more on ShotSpotter than the contract agreement and how ShotSpotter saves information. And that dates back to what? Sometime in the last few years, nothing has been updated. We've asked for information from the Rochester Police Department on how are you using it? Where is the information being stored? Are there restrictions on the information being sold to third-party vendors? Like, what is actually ongoing? Where are your sensors? How is this actually getting used? And the same sorts of questions are being asked of the Rochester Police Department, not just of ShotSpotter, but of drones, of stingrays, of you know, all these sorts of technology that they use and are often not getting feedback from the community as to, number one, do they even want this? Do they understand how invasive it actually is? Because at the end of the day, these sorts of devices will have such a large disparate impact on Black and brown people. That's why they're being used here in the city of Rochester. They are incredibly invasive. And I think this is important for the people to know so that they start questioning these sorts of devices and help themselves understand just why, if they aren't actually proving to be effective, why we're actually keeping them. So there's just a number of things that are popping up as we speak on this.
Yeah, and on that subject, as we take our early break of the hour, let me tell you what we're going to talk about when we come back here, because there's still a lot that we need to understand. First of all, what does ShotSpotter say in its own defense when it comes to the accuracy of this piece of technology? Todd Feathers will tell us about that. His writing, I think, helps elucidate some of what their claims are based on or what their claims are frankly not based on. So we'll talk about that coming up here. I want to stress again that there are some big decisions to be made. Rochester City Council, the current or the next mayor, the current or the next police chief will have to decide if they want to keep using ShotSpotter. And I've asked City Council for a number on how much we're paying for ShotSpotter. But there's also the broader question of, in communities that use ShotSpotter, and that's cities across the country, are we seeing better outcomes in public safety? Are we seeing better outcomes in policing, in evidence collection, in fairness and justice? We'll talk about that too with our guest, Todd Feathers, a freelance reporter writing about technology for Vice's Motherboard. Katie Higgins and Liz Riley are here. Katie Higgins is a senior assistant public defender, and Liz is a special assistant public defender. And Iman Abed Thompson is director of the Genesee Valley chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. We're right back with them after this short break. Coming up in our second hour, live music is back. And our colleague at City Magazine, Jeff Spivak, admits it kind of caught him by surprise. A lot of venues are finding ways to bring live shows to the public this summer. Some of it live just like you're used to, some of it sort of hybrid or changes in what is the typical protocol. So are you ready to see live music? We'll talk about how they're doing it next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. When you read Todd Feather's reporting about this for Motherboard, about ShotSpotter and about the way police departments are using it, what you see is, I mean, it's certainly not just Rochester. And just reading from the piece, Feathers writes, quotes Gal Pasetsky, who is the attorney for Godinez in Chicago. You hear about the Godinez case earlier this hour. And Pasetsky told Todd Feathers, quote, "The reliability of ShotSpotter technology has never been challenged in court, and nobody is doing anything about it. Chicago is paying millions of dollars for their technology and then, in a way, preventing anybody from challenging it," end quote. So what about the accuracy? Well, Todd Feathers talked to Paul Green, who is ShotSpotter's expert witness, and an employee of the company. And I'm just going to read from Feather's piece now, and we'll talk to Todd a little bit more about ShotSpotter's defense of their accuracy. Quote, "At the core of the opposition to ShotSpotter is the lack of empirical evidence that it works in terms of both its sensor accuracy and the system's overall effect on gun crime. The company is not allowed any independent testing of its algorithms, and there's evidence that the claims it makes in marketing materials about accuracy may not be entirely scientific. Over the years, ShotSpotter's claims about its accuracy have increased from 80% accurate to 90% accurate to 97% accurate. According to Green, those numbers aren't actually calculated by engineers, though. Our guarantee was put together by our sales and marketing department, not our engineers," Green told a San Francisco court in 2017. "We need to give them, the customers, a number. We have to tell them something. It's not perfect. The dot on the map is simply a starting point." End quote. It is hard to read that without laughing. I'm sorry, but come on, man. I mean, like, we're talking about technology that's literally putting people in prison, and you're telling police departments it's 90% accurate. Then you say, no, it's 97% accurate. And then one of your lead guys says, well, the people who came up with that's our marketing department, and says so. Todd Feathers, what else did you learn about, you know, what questions, I guess, do you still have? If you really were able to get all of the information in the most transparent way possible, what would you want to learn about ShotSpotter?
So there's another story in the works, specifically about how ShotSpotter determines gunshots, how it calculates locations, and how the humans involved in this process fit into that. And I think maybe it's worth backing up and just kind of explaining how this process works. A percussive or impulsive sound occurs in a city with ShotSpotter, and a number of sensors detect that sound. That's the first step. The second step is that the company's algorithms, they have, you know, more than a dozen different algorithms based on the environment and the kinds of sounds, perform an analysis and determine whether, you know, these algorithms believe that it is a gunshot, a firecracker, some kind of other sound. One of the company's co-founders has said previously in court testimony in San Francisco that those algorithms are not accurate enough on their own. And so the next stage in the process is that many of these go to a human reviewer who listens to the sounds to determine whether or not they're a gunshot. And as we've talked about in the Michael Williams case in Chicago, you know, human reviewers do change the classification for alerts. Paul Green from ShotSpotter has said in court testimony that this happens on a semi-regular basis with all of their customers. ShotSpotter has pushed back in statements to us for Vice, saying that this is a very rare occurrence. But what I think is really interesting here and what we're digging into for our next story is how the humans who work for ShotSpotter are trained. And Jason Dunham, one of the co-founders of ShotSpotter, testified in 2013 that the company has this library of sounds, some of which they know are gunshots because they were recorded during the company's testing in cities, some of which they believe to be gunshots, and some of which they believe to be something else. But the company, at least at that time in 2013, did not have any kind of pass-fail system for its analysts to determine whether they were good enough at recognizing gunshots. They didn't have any kind of metric for measuring how accurate humans were in general, and they've never published any kind of independent study about their algorithms or the humans involved to display accuracy levels. The numbers that they throw out, they say, you know, 97% are based on self-reported surveys from police departments. And there's some evidence to suggest that that's pretty questionable. Mm-hmm. But before we get onto that, I just want to add that the last part of this is, it's called a detailed forensic report. And that's what, you know, showed a fifth shot in the Sylvain Simmons case. And that is something that the company says takes 8 hours to prepare by a specialist. And we have no idea what that entails and how they're able to find gunshots that were not previously detected by an algorithm, by a supposedly trained human, and how they're able to, you know, calculate the location of these sounds better than a computer is.
Okay. Well, I guess then we should ask before, I know Iman wants to talk about, and I want to talk about too, about concern about maybe other tools or, you know, the way the NYCLU sees not just ShotSpotter, but sort of the larger context of tools that are used for whether it's evidence collection, police, prosecution, et cetera. But to me, at the core of this, of all of this, is this helping communities? Is this working? Is this making people safer? Is this making outcomes better, fairer, more just? Todd, is there any evidence that says to you, yes, millions of dollars being spent on ShotSpotter and it is producing good results in communities?
So ShotSpotter sent us a study from the policing project at New York University that demonstrated a 30% drop in assaults in St. Louis County, Missouri, after the system was installed there. As we say in the piece, the policing project at New York University, well, actually a very reputable organization, I'm not trying to disparage them in any way, they have done some good research. They have received unrestricted funding from ShotSpotter since 2018. ShotSpotter CEO sits on the project's board, and some of the researchers involved in that St. Louis County report had previously been compensated by ShotSpotter. And this is kind of typical of the research that you see coming out of ShotSpotter. It's all based on data that ShotSpotter provides. It's actually really hard to gauge the effects of this because, you know, from a scientific perspective, no two neighborhoods are the same. You can't put ShotSpotter in one neighborhood, not have it in another neighborhood, and be able to draw a direct comparison in terms of, you know, gun crime or arrests. They're just different factors in those two places. And similarly, when a city, you know, institutes ShotSpotter, it's usually coupled with some kind of intensified policing program, maybe other programs like gun buybacks, that may contribute to this. But what I think is really important is that I was just running the numbers this morning, is how many times ShotSpotter ends up sending police into communities, and these are almost exclusively Black and Brown communities, as we've talked about, when there's no evidence that a crime was committed. There's a study in Chicago that showed that over a 21-month period, 86% of the alerts, you know, led to no evidence of a gun crime, and 89% of the alerts led to no evidence of a crime at all. If you just look at the shooting numbers in Chicago, between 2017 and 2021, there were more than 17,000, you know, distinct addresses in Chicago that had at least one ShotSpotter alert generated. During that same period of time, though, there were only 12,500 shootings, which means that about 4,500 times over a 4.5-year period, ShotSpotter reported a possible shooting, but police couldn't confirm it. And that's 4,500 times that Chicago police responded to a location in the city in a Black and Brown community on high alert because they were expecting somebody with a gun when there's no evidence that there was ever anybody there. And I think that, you know, a lot of community members see that as a recipe for something tragic to happen to somebody.
That's why going forward, we all in this community and journalists, I mean, we have a role to play. We at least need to ask city council, the administration, whichever administration is leading at the time, how do you justify this? I mean, why are we investing in this? What are the outcomes that you can point to and say, this is good stuff. This is working. Liz Riley, is there a benefit to ShotSpotter as you see it? Can it be an effective tool?
If it worked properly, I think it could be an effective tool to get aid to people who are injured. So I am philosophically opposed to it being used as a crime prevention tool. First of all, I can't imagine how it prevents crime. People don't think about, well, is there a ShotSpotter sensor possibly in this location before I shoot this guy? That's just not how the world works. Could it be useful to alert medical personnel to someone who may need medical assistance? If it worked correctly, sure.
I mean, if you had a magic situation where it was truly 97%, or if it was close to 100%, but I think what we just heard from Todd Feathers, I mean, 4,500 times in a couple of years, mm-hmm. police get called in one city to a scene where there's not a gunshot fired. They are ramped up. I mean, that's a dangerous scenario.
And that's a scary situation to have in our community because you're having multiple officers respond on high alert looking for a crime, looking for someone who is armed, which puts them in a different state of mind emotionally.
You're also wasting their time, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the best case scenario, not financially, but that's the best case scenario. Worst case scenario is they run into someone who
there's a misunderstanding. Sure. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just very dangerous.
Okay. Katie Higgins, do you see a benefit to ShotSpotter?
not given the current technology and what we know about it. I just think, you know, that again, the way it was initially probably sold to all of these municipalities was as a tool for law enforcement to respond in, I think the way ShotSpotter phrased it, was neighborhoods where residents may not be as likely to call 911 if they were to witness, you know, gunshots or hear gunshots. But it's used as so much more than that, and there's so many times when it's, you know, officers are called out to respond to an alert and there's nothing there, or vice versa. It's so not effective at anything that it's claiming to do.
Iman, is there an effective use for ShotSpotter that you can see?
No. I think that this program has been, and this device has been around for a few years now, and we've seen just how faulty it is, and I'm not here to convince anyone that this system or this device itself can be reformed.
There's no reform. There's no... Okay, yeah.
No.
Who do you then think needs... is it city council? Is it the mayor's office? Is it the police department? Who needs to really tell the community, here's why we're going to continue spending money on this? Especially if the DA's office is now saying, hey, for the last 2 years, we haven't even used this as evidence.
I think there are a couple of things that both city council and the mayor's office, and we are going to see a change in administration, and I'm looking forward to what's about to come. I think there are candidates you know, newly elected folks who are very supportive of questioning the police department in ways that I think we haven't been able to question them before. I think bare bone, what we should be asking of the police department, every elected official in city council should be asking for information. We should have that data. We should have an understanding of what is actually happening with these devices. You're spending money on it and you're approving of that funding. So at least try to get to why it's being used and how it's being used and what it's actually doing. I mean, we're sitting here, just the four, five of us, and trying to have a conversation about, like, what is this tool? Like, we shouldn't be asking ourselves that if we're going back to a case from 2016. Like, we should have known that by now. We're in 2021. I think that, again, the same thing goes for other pieces of technology. And I think this is an opportunity right now to start saying, okay, well, we're not going to even implement these programs until we understand what they are. And city council can actually mandate that. Syracuse has actually been really pushing for things like that, a whole new process around how we investigate these sorts of devices before they're getting implemented so that we have a better understanding and then a policy around it. We've sat down with the Rochester Police Department so many times demanding policies for these devices, from the drones to the stingrays, whatever they may be. And that's policy, asking them to actually have, you know, written down what are these actually being used for, so we have something to hold them accountable to, and they won't even do that. So let alone, you know, you're trying to have these conversations, you're trying to get them to use these sorts of programs, you know, effectively, so that we also understand that, and historically it just hasn't happened. So at a stage now in 2021, no, I say that these devices cannot be reformed and we should be doing away with them and kind of start from scratch around what it is that we actually want to implement.
Are there other tools beyond ShotSpotter that concern you?
Yeah, I mean, there's X-ray vans, there's stingrays, there's drones.
What is a stingray?
I believe it acts as a cell phone simulator, so it can pick up on a specific geographic range of people's cell phones, from my understanding. So it acts as a cell phone simulator. And again, we don't even know how that device is used. So as we were talking about the fact that ShotSpotter can pick up audio recordings, and that's a clear violation of one's rights, not knowing that audio of one's conversation, if it's in proximity to a sensor, can be collected. We're also talking about stingray, where somebody may be looking for a specific individual, but captures information on someone's cell phone from a broad geographic range. And we, to this day, we have no idea how they're being used.
Yeah, I mean, it seems pretty logical to me. I remember when the Ray's Commission report came out, and former Mayor Johnson, who was one of the co-chairs, was on this program, explaining that they couldn't even get information on who is training the police, who RPD is hiring to train them, and what the training materials are. I mean, this should be basic. If our tax dollars are paying for it, police, you know, should be employed to protect communities. That's the ideal, and to make for more safety and more justice for communities. If we're paying you, we should know what tools you're using and how they work. I don't think it should be complicated. I don't know why we need a situation, you know, because somebody will email me today and say, well, if you haven't done anything wrong, then you shouldn't care. That's all, you know, which, I mean, which sort of seems maybe logical until you think of Sylvan Simmons, mm-hmm. who pulled into his driveway and had an officer ready to chase and shoot him. And then he got charged with a crime for it. So it's I think we at least need a little bit more transparency. I don't know if that's too much to ask. Katie Higgins, do you feel like, whether it's stingrays or whatever else they're using, do you feel like we could, there's a lot more that we should know about how they're using these tools?
Absolutely, and especially just the experience that we've had with ShotSpotter and how little we know about how the technology works and how not transparent the information is. It makes it very difficult to protect our own constitutional rights and those of our clients without having any of that information. How do you possibly challenge what happened without having any of that information? I would also, just in response to the statement provided by the district attorney's office that they no longer use this as evidence, I think that's a bit disingenuous. They may not be using it as primary evidence. So in Sylvan's case, it was, apart from Officer Frigno and his partner's testimony, the only evidence of that they presented of Sylvan trying to fire or firing a gun was the audio, the ShotSpotter audio file and the forensic report. That was presented as primary evidence, so essentially given to the jury as evidence that they could accept and use to make their, while they're deliberating. It is still used day in and day out by police officers in terms of making decisions as to whether to pull a car over or stop somebody walking down the street. And all of that is still used in terms of possible suppression issues and Fourth Amendment violations in all of these cases that the prosecutors are presenting. So even though it may not be presented, they may not be using it as primary evidence after the Simmons case, they still are using it as one reason why police may have stopped a vehicle or searched a person, and which leads to a whole other string of issues.
Well, I mean, we've reached the end of the allotted time for this, but there's a lot more to discuss in the future. And certainly we'll be in touch with City Council and members of the incoming administration to find out if they plan any reforms or changes, whether it's ShotSpotter or other technology or just transparency issues. I think all of that matters. And I want to thank Todd Feathers, a reporter whose piece helped spark this. It's important work, Todd, and I hope we can talk again. We do appreciate what you've done on this, and I know you're still working on some other related stories. We'll be following that as well. Thanks for making time for the program.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you all.
Todd Feathers, a freelance reporter writing about technology. Find his work in Motherboard. Iman Abid Thompson, director of the Genesee Valley chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Thanks for being here, Iman.
Thank you, Evan.
From the Public Defender's Office, Katie Higgins is a senior assistant public defender. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Evan.
Elizabeth Riley is a special assistant public defender. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
More connections coming up in a moment.